This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's side two of tape 448, and it's July the 4th, 1980. In order to understand where Ronald Reagan is coming from, you have to go back to the historical roots of the people that selected Ronald Reagan. Their first official president, selected and groomed by this team of thinkers to prepare us for World War III, was Richard Nixon. That was their first selected candidate. Then it took a lot of murders and attempted murders to kill other candidates and witnesses, and domestic and international murders, particularly the domestic I'm concerned with here, in order to make way for Ronald Reagan to become the next selected and manipulated president of the United States. There was an article going back 1976, that's quite a while back, that I have from the San Jose Mercury, Hoover Institution, a major conservative think tank. This is an article on the influence on U.S. domestic affairs, primarily our domestic affairs, our prisons, hospitals, the so-called welfare cheaters, the racism, the killing of Chicanos and black leaders, and so forth, goes back to the influence of the domestic affairs that was decided at Stanford University. This article, written quite a few years ago in 76, describes the Hoover Institution as the major conservative think tank on domestic, on our own personal level, outside at a time, specifically today, that we celebrate July the 4th, our independence from Great Britain. A long time ago, you wonder, well, what did we gain by fighting? Taxation without representation, we certainly have that now. And what advantage was there not to be British if we were going to turn the route that we did? Why bother to have the Revolutionary Wars or Civil Wars or any other kinds of wars? They're all ridiculous because nothing is accomplished, and nothing proves that more than the intent to disrupt the Constitution and the Bill of Rights by an organization located in Palo Alto, such as the Hoover Think Tank. In 1976, that was 13 years ago, they claimed that conservatives are looking to Hoover as an antidote to the more liberal output that's coming out of Brookings Institute or Harvard. If you think Harvard is liberal, just wait till Stanford gets into the White House, the Hoover people. It goes on to say the Hoover scholars had an impact on Richard Nixon, you bet they did, and Gerald Ford, and they will on Ronald Reagan. This is talking about his bid for presidency in 1976, but after Rockefeller was murdered and Jimmy Carter was totally discredited or split up with John Anderson and Ted Kennedy's votes, the hope is now to get Ronald Reagan. The article says that Ronald Reagan joined the exiled Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn as the only two honorary fellows at Hoover Institute. He donated 20 tons of his State House papers to the Institute, and he does his research and writing out of the Institute. He's influenced by people, Hoover scholars, who testify before congressional committees, and they name one, a Glenn Campbell from the University of California. Reagan named him on the regent as a regent for the University of California, and his wife is an economist and works with this Hoover group. There are so-called scholars that influence the domestic policies of the United States. Mr. Campbell, who's on the Board of Regents, took time out to be the advisor to Barry Goldwater during his campaign for presidency. The Hoover Tower was begun and founded by Herbert Hoover in 1919. As I've said many times, and it's documented in the book The Great Conspiracy and other books on Herbert Hoover's life, he had financial investment of billions in oil companies in Russia that were taken by the communists, and he wanted to avenge that and regain his personal profit. So as president of the United States, later as Secretary of Commerce, he brought us into a Great Depression, arming us. It was arms against butter in order to make war against the Soviet Union, and the momentum and the propaganda build up so much that today almost every country in the world is bankrupt, just maintaining arms enough in the hopes that they will someday conquer Russia and regain the oil and gold and minerals that they would love to have in their own pockets. A recent article came out in the Los Angeles Times, the Hoover-Reagan Campaign Resource, and it explains that Herbert Hoover got it for a bargain in 1919. It was a $50,000 gift. He founded the institution to establish and demonstrate the evils of Karl Marx, and now it provides all the intellectual underpinnings for Ronald Reagan's conservatism. The Hoover Institute on War, Revolution and Then Peace is the nation's think tank that keeps the anti-Russian information propaganda going constantly. Reagan feels at home at the Hoover Tower. This one article explains Hoover is so comfortable with him that the institution not only made him an honorary fellow member, but they will follow him to Washington when he becomes president of the United States. They collect raw material of history. They collected information ever since Hoover, President Hoover, was the relief coordinator in Europe in World War I. They keep all kinds of documents. They have the original diary of Nazi Heinrich Himmler, and they have cartons of information from Gestapo Germany. They have the list that the Gestapo had of the British people that would be rounded up for execution if the Nazis got into England. That is a repository in the tower, and of course it fed into Interpol and could be used again if these people are in power. There could be assassination squads if they're not all dead already by suicides or car crashes, airplane crashes, and so forth. The death list of the British people, which I'm sure they were never notified about, is a repository in this institution. The chief archivist is Milorad Drakovic, whose father is minister of the interior in Yugoslavia in the First War. In World War II government, he was assassinated by the communists, so he has a motive to get even with the Russians, not Adolf Hitler, who provoked the war, or the corporations that funded Hitler. Vasily Romanov, the nephew of the Tsar Nicholas II, the Prince of Russia, is the honorary curator of this great Hoover Institute, where they have this Imperial Russian collection and the greatest amount of material outside of Russia in the world. It's hard for me to believe that I was so close to many events that were going to occur in my research later, and in my innocence, going to Stanford University for 4 years, we used to hear the bell, the tower, the Acrolon ring every hour at the Hoover Tower, and it was so beautiful. It was sent from the Netherlands, I believe, and the sound of it was very beautiful. And the farthest thing from my mind in the years 1940 to 43, the 4 years I was there, was anything that was going on in the Hoover Tower. I was a philosophy major, and I could care less, and nobody on campus was aware of the accumulation of this material being put into the tower. One of the biggest and most public persons that feeds information here and uses it for his research is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the other fellow membership, along with Ronald Reagan. A current article said Solzhenitsyn's portrait pops up everywhere in the building, as often as Herbert Hoover or Ronald Reagan's. After Solzhenitsyn's exile from Russia, President Ford, on the advice of Henry Kissinger, felt that entertaining him in the White House would ruin d'entente at the time, but he went right out to the Hoover Tower where he worked, and it was a resource. He used documents to write his novel, August 1914. Another man on the Hoover staff that you know is physicist Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, tax expert Dan Throop Smith, welfare expert Martin Anderson, Thomas Gale Moore, and Richard Starr, the Russian-speaking chronicler of Soviet affairs, are on the board as economists. All of them will go to Washington with Ronald Reagan. Martin Anderson is a close advisor to Reagan. He's on the board of the Hoover Tower. He rides with him on the campaign plane. Darrell Trent, who held a half a dozen jobs in the Nixon White House, was Reagan's deputy campaign manager in 76 and is working for Reagan again. This is from a recent Los Angeles Times article. Hoover Director Campbell, that's the man in charge of the towers who took the lead for Barry Goldwater's campaign, has been working close with Ronald Reagan, as well as, I say, being on the Board of Regents at the University of California. You might get reprints of these articles from your local newspapers. One by Mike Fensler that I just read from the Associated Press. There's another one from the Washington Bureau of the San Jose Mercury, Californians Guiding Ronald Reagan. And there's a picture of Lynn Nofziger, that's the gentleman that worked with John Mitchell and the American Nazi Party at the time of Watergate. Reagan has this entourage of the think tank from the Hoover Institute and the most far-right consulting firms and corporations behind him as he pushes to become president of the United States. William Casey, the gentleman that's working with Ronald Reagan, was appointed to two important jobs by Henry Kissinger at one time. I will do more on Casey later, but William J. Casey was recruited by former Treasury Secretary William Simon, and he's one of Reagan's close advisors. It's interesting that William J. Casey, formerly from the Security Exchange Commission at the time of a lot of exposés that were covered up at Watergate, claims that his interest in politics goes back to the 1940 campaign of New York Republican Thomas Dewey. And that was the first campaign in the 40s after the war to the use of Mary Carter Paint Company, organized crime, and the intelligence community to push a candidate for the President of the United States. That Dewey campaign was the first combined effort of the crime syndicate and the intelligence community to push for the presidency, and this is where William Casey began to get involved in political campaigns. And then Mary Carter Paint Company went on down to the Bahamas to become Resorts International and formed a corporation known Intertel. And Intertel controlled Howard Hughes, the Hughes people who wanted Paul Lazalt, who's now running Reagan's campaign, the senator from Nevada, the one who's pushing that secret intelligence czar spy system. The Intertel was formed from Resorts International. And the network from William Casey in New York and the Security Exchange and Dewey, the Bahamas, Nevada, and Reagan and the think tanks is a network of intelligence persons trained in the FBI, the CIA, involved in narcotics, organized crime, czarists, Nazis, the worst kinds of people that push pogroms in Russia, the greedy exploitation of the czars, and when they were removed, the wealth divided among the Russians, known as a form of economic alternative, known as capitalism. The Western world became frantic. Europe and Asia became frantic that Russia might give other countries the idea of divesting the power in the hands of the few and the wealth. And they set up these organizations of think tanks all over the world. But they synchronize, when it comes to making domestic and foreign policy of causing bloodbaths in South Africa or bloodbaths going on now in Nicaragua or Guatemala, particularly Guatemala, that is about to be wiped out, the United Fruit Company Nation. And the same names of the think tanks and the czars and Nazis and organized crime that want the intelligence system perverted, that want to take away the trial by jury with a new constitution, the same names are coming from 50 states and interlocking and weaving, and all are compiled into certain people that have been selected for the office of presidency in the United States, where the laws will protect their financial exploitation to the nth degree. The Hoover think tank for conservatives is nothing but a group of people determined to break our economy by making a war against Russia in order to divest that system of the idea of dividing wealth or natural resources among the few. The plans for the intelligence agency, for the Pentagon, come from those kind of people that are working in the Hoover think tank and running men like Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon, who are puppet face men, or Gerald Ford, and a few transitional men like Jimmy Carter or Lyndon Johnson, till they get total control of the entire military and the White House and the intelligence network, like Hitler did in Germany in 1933, by overlooking the murders and perverting the court system, they come to power. And the people behind Ronald Reagan are those very people that are writing the new charter for the intelligence, FBI, and the CIA. And the private organization outside of the FBI and CIA that hasn't been named yet, but probably will be called the Gestapo. The Hoover Institute was formed in 1919, as soon as the Russian Revolution was over, just as the Broderbund were formed in South Africa about the same time period, and Cecil Rhodes Roundtable in England, and our Council of Foreign Relations in the United States. There's a line in the play Tiny Alice by Edward Albee that, I don't remember verbatim, it goes, "Be careful of what you ask, because you may just get it, and your wish may come true." I think the wish of these people to conquer and make war and constantly make war is probably going to come true, and they're not going to get what they dreamed they would have. 1917 or 1919, when these plans were made and these candidates were picked, the minds and hearts of the people were very controllable, just as labor unions or labor and slave labor was controllable. But the confrontations that are going to take place are going to be bloody and many. And as the women testified just last week on the anniversary of Hiroshima and the bombings, the atomic bombs falling in Japan, they said, "The living will envy the dead." Helen Douglas, died this last week, Helen Cahagan Douglas. Many of you can go to books about Richard Nixon and his early career and get many, many pages on the saga of Helen Douglas. What you won't get, you'll get the stories of how Nixon called her a red and ruined her career in 1950. She was going to run for the Senate. She'd been in Congress for 6 years, a fine woman, an intelligent person. You'll get a lot of stories of the way Nixon tainted her career and ruined her political career and pushed her out of office. But what you don't get are the connecting links of the earlier years, the czarists that were accumulating in Palo Alto in what was to become the Hoover think tank, and the chronology of this period. Earlier, as I say, in 1940, these people were hell-bent on us becoming involved in this other war and using the Germans against the Soviet Union. And in 1946, Richard Nixon, when the war was over, was selected by a committee of 100, a group of agricultural people, aerospace people, Lockheed, Howard Hughes, to run against Mr. Voorhees, a man that was in Congress. And Richard Nixon began that red smear. That's when his politics began, his debut began. There are many, many books on the subject. I have one book here by William Costello, The Facts About Nixon, the unauthorized biography of his formative years. And this goes a little bit into his power, how he got it. But it was these people that had a lot of influence in California who selected him as a front, as they selected Ronald Reagan when he was on General Electric Theater to become president of the United States someday, even if it took 400 murders to get him there. This book describes Voorhees, as I say, his election in 1946 and the red smear, and how the Committee of 100 funded Richard Nixon and put up money for him, and at the same time they were funding William Nolan's Senate campaign, this Murray Chotiner, who later was killed at the time of Watergate. And then after his successful campaign in the House of Representatives, he prosecuted Alger Hiss and became known as the great fighter of communism, and he was going full steam. You know, the McCarthy years were beginning, the blacklisting of people. And then in 1950, after they had arrested and prosecuted Alger Hiss, then a woman named Helen Douglas came along, and then he began the bigger game. This book describes he was armed by 1949, Richard Nixon, for a bigger game. He had the Alger Hiss case behind him. He proved that red smear worked, and he compared her voting record to a man who admittedly was interested in socialism or possibly communism as an alternative to the kind of capitalism we were moving towards. And then he compared her votes to this man and said, therefore, if they vote the same on certain issues, they're communists. She never could gain momentum. He had all kinds of outside money and organizations and slurs and pink stationery he used, and was working with Senator Joe McCarthy, who came in California on his behalf to speak for him. And along with him was Gerald Smith and a Christian nationalist crusade, and they came out for an Anglo-Saxon Christian meeting in support of Richard Nixon. Now, it isn't surprising that a group that I mentioned on the tape just several weeks ago wants the world all Christian, and John Conley and Leon Jaworski and people, Clint Murchison and the Hunt brothers, people involved with the Kennedy assassination, and then the subsequent escalation of the war in Vietnam, an anti-communist crusade, while making tremendous profits all the time. These people were behind Nixon very early in his career, and Richard Nixon, of course, was at Murchison's home the night before John Kennedy was killed. November 21st, 1963, he left Love Airfield that same morning. Kennedy came in and was later killed, and then Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford to the Warren Commission. Gerald Smith and his Christian nationalist crusade were in Los Angeles in February 27, 1950. They told the crusade that the man that they wanted, the man who uncovered Alger Hiss, is in California, and that he would do house cleaning, and they would help Richard Nixon get rid of the Jew communists. This was part of his campaign. And part of the campaign of Gerald Smith was that Helen Douglas was the wife of a Jew. And you Californians can do one thing, he said, to help the ideals of Christian nationalism. Don't send to the Senate the wife of a Jew. This is part of Richard Nixon's campaign in 1950, running and working with the China lobby. They also were part of his campaign in 1950, the China lobby that was violently anti-communist, anti-change in the Chinese government, supporting Chiang Kai-shek, and, of course, that China Laba goes into Madame Chenault and the Flying Tigers, and Gerald Ford, again of the Warren Commission, is now on the board of directors of the Flying Tigers. As I say, there are many books on Nixon's career, but if you separate the Alger Hiss case and the McCarthy years and the Rosenberg case or the Richard Nixon career, the war of Vietnam or Korea or getting ready for World War III in the Middle East now, if you separate our weapons contracts, our missiles and planes contracts this week, the $51.9 billion allocation, the new draft registration, the escaping of radiation in Pennsylvania, Three Mile Island, if you separate those as separate incidences, you're missing the point of history because there is a linear connection of persons and places involved in the past that, as I say, write our headlines today. In this one book, The Facts About Nixon, there is the epilogue of Nixon's career written in January 1957. A British publisher went to Richard Nixon and asked him about his campaign against Helen Douglas, and he explained his campaign against Helen Douglas was, he said, "I'm sorry about it. It was a mistake," in quotes. "I'm sorry about that episode. I was a very young man." In order to become president, he had to publish those pink sheets and the slur because the people putting him in office needed it to get him into office. 1950 was the year that Nixon defeated Helen Douglas on the Red Smear. He started with Voorhees in 1946 in this country ever since, and since World War II has been going, actually since World War I, has been going gung-ho to help the Nazis, help the anti-communists, such as people coming in from Cuba, not wanting people coming in from Haiti or Chile or Argentina. Fascist repressive governments or South African governments are not people. If they are fighting fascism, they are considered human fodder and animal. If they fight communism, they're welcome. What was happening in 1950? I was just looking up some information in the Encyclopedia Britannica. In the front of it, they have each year a chronology of what transpired the year before. And I just thought a few of these items might be of interest to you. At the time that Nixon was defeating Helen Douglas, January the 8th, Attorney General John Howard McGrath stated that he supported wiretapping by the FBI because of the emergency which still existed in the United States. This was 30 years ago, the news of 1950. Alger Hiss was found guilty by a federal grand jury of perjury. He denied passing documents to Whitaker Chambers and denied seeing Whitaker Chambers in January the 1st, 1937. And, of course, later it turns out that Chambers had contacts in Germany and with Henry Luce in Life magazine and was set to detract or take away from the work that Alger Hiss was doing in exposing the rearmament of Germany in 1937 and the use of the DuPonts and Mellons and Morgans to arm Europe for World War II. That was Alger Hiss's crime. January the 28th, there was an agreement by Harry Truman to furnish $1 billion for U.S. arms to Belgium, Denmark, France, United Kingdom, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway. It was signed in Washington, D.C. President Truman also directed the U.S. Atomic Energy to continue work on all forms of atomic weapons, including the so-called hydrogen bomb or the super bomb that in 1950. February the 8th, the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, told a press conference that any agreements with Russia were worthless unless they were backed by strength and backed by force. And the men who made the strength and made the force were the Committee of 100 and the arms merchants from the east to the west who made money building weapons and telling us we needed these weapons while they profited into the new millionaires and billionaires, the Daniel Ludwigs, the Howard Hughes, the Aerospace, Roy Ash, Litton Industries, Boeing, Lockheed, Rockwell, the new millionaires are the defense millionaires. February 26th, General MacArthur announced that Japan would be permitted to join in international agreements with technical conferences. This was a year after the atomic bomb. U.S. High Commissioner John J. McCloy in 1950 warned Germany that we would use power and influence to head off the revival of Nazism. And 7 years later, McCloy in 1957 released all Nazis from prisons and jails to continue their national and international meetings to rearm for World War III. And John J. McCloy, of course, was on the Rockefeller Foundation, head of Chase Manhattan Bank, and on the Warren Commission with Alan Dulles to cover up the use of the Nazis and the Tsarists in the killing of John Kennedy. for the purposes of escalating the war and taking a hold to rearm this country into the warfare state it is today. March 1950, Attorney General Howard McGrath and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover refused to turn over to the Senate any part of their files on State Department or personnel accused of disloyalty. You could continue with McCarthy hearings and political campaigns accusing people of being spies and being disloyal, and the Attorney General and the FBI would not disprove those allegations or those smears. They refused to turn to the Senate any information so the public officials could continue to campaign and make aspersions about socialist or communist linkings, such as Helen Douglas, but the Attorney General and the Director of the FBI would not support or deny these claims. They wouldn't turn them over. Former President Herbert Hoover, who had formed his Tower, a think tank in 1919 for domestic policies, proposed that the United Nations be reorganized by 1950. This was 4 years after the war, without any communist participation. No communists could be there. Truman rejected that proposal. June the 1st, President Truman asked Congress for $225,500,000,000 for more military aid to foreign countries during his second year of mutual defense assistance program. At the beginning of the year, they only allocated $1 billion, but they went up billions for the new defense system for other countries, and the Atomic Energy Commission in that year named E.I. DuPont de Nemours and Company to build and operate plants for production of the hydrogen bomb. And, of course, the president of DuPont, Mr. Shapiro, is on the Trilateral Committee and is a cabinet member of Jimmy Carter's campaign. And July 17th of 1950, Julius Rosenberg was arrested on charge of conspiracy to commit espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union. And then the Rosenberg case escalated as another cause celeb to keep going after Russia. And in 1950, we were back in Asia, or getting our foot in Asia, rather, with entering the Korean War. I'm not going to do all the major events of 1950. Let's just do a half a year to show you the intent of peace was never there. By 1950, when the war was over, it had been over 5 years since 1945 when the troops went into Germany, the East and West, Russian and American troops. The intent of public officials right then and there was to always be anti-Soviet, arm the other countries, leave the Russians out of discussions and so forth, armed to the teeth, and prepare ourselves for that final push that Napoleon couldn't do and Alexander the Great couldn't do, the Germans couldn't do twice, and deplete the United States of its technology, its citizens, its wealth, its sanity, literally taking away their minds, mind control experiments, and chemicals to control masses, to get them to be willing robots, which most people are today, to maintain a warfare status against an enemy that was created for the sole purpose of profits. The Soviet Union has always been the object of fear for all the major countries where the profit system was the greatest, where you get the greatest gap between the rich and the poor. Communism is feared the most. The countries where there is not that large gap, communism isn't feared as much because the rich people don't have that much to lose. Thugs were executed. It was just an anniversary. 1957, June 22nd, I should have mentioned it last week on the tape of the week before, they were executed in 1953 for passing along secret information, which later is very much questioned. And the Rosenberg story, like the Alger Hiss story, the Richard Nixon story, the Ronald Reagan story, have never truthfully been told. Speaking of the Rosenbergs, Judge Kaufman, who prosecuted and meted out the death sentence to the Rosenbergs instead of allowing them to live to find out if, in fact, there was a spy ring or if they were framed, finally resigned from the bench in New York City. He's been on there about 22 years. He's done enough damage, and he finally has stepped down. It's just a shame there isn't more time. I have about 80 more stories to go through with you next week. I'll maybe speed them up without so much opinion. But I feel very strongly that sometimes, in addition to just taking the news isolated and throwing it out at you, I have to throw in my own feelings about it and the connecting links and the dangers that we're facing in the future. These elections are the elections that the Gestapo wanted. This is the 1933 of America, and Reagan is the Gestapo. The only difference between this and Nazi Germany is that there are more people aware now of the problems, and there's more knowledge of resistance, and there's more anger and frustration. There's more journalists alert. There's more people fighting to make their children survive, and it isn't identical to the past. It's a different ball game, and we still have a few freedoms, and we're going to lose them, but we'll fight for them and form resistance movements. But there is a different kind of energy that can possibly destroy these people, but you have to first be alert to the problems. In order to stop them, you have to analyze what they're doing and how they got there, and that, of course, is the purpose of these tapes every week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. You take care, and I'll be back with you next week. Thank you.